self-harm, a phenomenon that touches more lives than most realize, with over one-fifth of young people reporting having harmed themselves. Yet, despite its prevalence, misconceptions abound. Is it a cry for attention? A failed suicide attempt? A teenage phase? The reality is far more complex and nuanced than these simplistic views suggest. In understanding and responding to self-harm, psychiatrist Alan House draws on 15 years of clinical experience to shatter myths and provide clarity on this often misunderstood behavior. The book has gained recognition among mental health professionals as an essential resource, praised by organizations like Mind and the Samaritans for its balanced, non-judgmental approach. Unlike sensationalized media portrayals or clinical texts that reduce self-harm to diagnostic criteria, House offers something different, a compassionate roadmap for both those who self-harm and those who want to help them. Self-harm discussions often become muddled because the term isn't used consistently. The World Health Organization defines it as intentional, non-habitual acts aimed at causing physical changes to oneself, while the UK's National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence more simply calls it self-poisoning or self-injury, irrespective of the apparent purpose of the act. This definition emphasizes that self-harm is an action, not an identity. It's offensive and counterproductive to label someone a cutter or self-harmer. Importantly, self-harm doesn't always indicate suicidal intent. Many use it to defend against suicidal thoughts, though those who self-harm do have higher suicide rates than the general population. The key point is that we shouldn't make assumptions about whether someone who is self-harmed intended to die. Many harmful behaviors aren't typically categorized as self-harm, including body piercing, extreme dieting, and substance abuse. These are considered indirectly harmful behaviors because their primary purpose isn't bodily damage. They're also often socially approved within certain groups, unlike self-harm, which is viewed as having individual, abnormal psychological causes. Self-harm takes many forms. While cutting is most commonly depicted in media, self-poisoning, typically overdoses of painkillers or psychiatric medications, is more commonly seen in hospitals. Self-injury includes cutting with razors or glass, commonly on forearms and thighs, burning with cigarettes, inserting objects into the body, punching walls, and headbanging. Some acts are impulsive, while others are carefully planned. About 25% of people who self-harm will do so again within a year, often switching methods, which is why focusing on methods rather than underlying causes is unhelpful. The seriousness of self-harm can be assessed in three dimensions: physical, depending on the substance and quantity used or depth of injury; social, how it impacts daily functioning and relationships; and psychological, the underlying emotional issues. These don't necessarily correlate. A physically minor overdose might reflect profound hopelessness, while a medically dangerous one could stem from a temporary emotional state. Self-harm patterns show distinct age and gender distributions that challenge common stereotypes. While rare before puberty, cases begin emerging around age 12-13, peak dramatically in the early 20s, then gradually decline with age. Though often viewed as exclusively a youth issue, a quarter of hospital cases involve people over 40, with some cases extending into the elderly population. The decline with age likely reflects both more settled life circumstances, better developed coping mechanisms, and increased access to professional support networks. Additionally, older adults often developed more sophisticated emotional regulation strategies through life experience. Gender patterns reveal complex dynamics. Girls and young women self-harm at rates 2 to 3 times higher than boys in early adolescence, though this difference diminishes by the late 20s. This disparity likely stems from different gendered responses to stress. Young men more commonly express distress through substance abuse, aggressive behavior, or risk-taking activities, while young women, conditioned by societal focus on appearance and internalized pressure, tend toward bodily expressions of distress. Cultural expectations about emotional expression also play a role, with men often feeling less able to openly acknowledge emotional struggles. The dramatic increase in self-harm rates over recent decades raises important questions about societal changes. Rates among young people have increased 3 to 4-fold since the 1990s, suggesting it has become a more socially recognized response to distress. This trend correlates with rising academic pressure, social media influence, and economic uncertainty. However, increased reporting and better recognition by healthcare providers may also contribute to higher recorded rates. While some worry about social contagion, especially through online communities, evidence suggests self-harm remains a deeply personal response to genuine emotional pain rather than a socially transmitted behavior. The demographic picture extends beyond common assumptions about ethnicity. Research shows significant rates of self-harm among young South Asian women, particularly those caught between traditional family expectations and modern Western culture. However, data on other ethnic groups remains limited due to unreliable ethnicity recording in health records and reluctance among minority groups to use mental health services. Cultural barriers, including stigma, language difficulties, and fears of discrimination or cultural misunderstanding, often prevent individuals from seeking help. Some communities may also have different cultural expressions of distress that go unrecognized by Western medical frameworks. Socioeconomic factors also influence self-harm patterns, with higher rates in areas of economic deprivation. This correlation highlights the role of environmental stressors, limited access to mental health resources, and the impact of financial instability on psychological well-being. Understanding these broader demographic patterns is crucial for developing targeted prevention strategies and culturally sensitive support services. Understanding self-harm requires looking beyond demographic factors to examine individuals' life circumstances. Common themes in self-harm narratives include relationship difficulties, characterized by tension, arguments, sometimes violence, relationship losses, breakups or bereavements, practical problems, financial difficulties, housing problems, unemployment, physical illness, particularly with chronic pain, and struggles with sexuality, especially uncertainty about orientation or fear of rejection. While circumstances matter significantly, individual differences help explain why some people self-harm when stressed while others don't. Certain thinking styles increase vulnerability to self-harm. Hopeless thinking, automatically assuming negative outcomes based on past experiences of powerlessness, limits one's ability to envision positive change. Black and white thinking eliminates middle ground possibilities, creating false dichotomies like, if everything isn't okay, it's a disaster. These cognitive patterns impair both emotional coping and practical problem solving. Early life experiences profoundly shape who we become, particularly regarding relationships and self-perception. Many who self-harm have histories of unhappy childhoods involving neglect, where necessary care is missing, or abuse, where actively harmful experiences occur. Emotional abuse and neglect, though less visible than physical or sexual abuse, can be equally damaging to self-esteem and the ability to form trusting relationships. Contrary to popular belief, only about 35% of people seeking help after self-harm have a diagnosable psychiatric disorder, challenging the assumption that mental illness explains most self-harm. Severe depression is the mental disorder most commonly associated with self-harm, creating both intolerable suffering and hopelessness. Psychotic disorders account for relatively few hospital self-harm cases. Perhaps no aspect of self-harm generates more confusion than its relationship with suicide. While some acts of self-harm are indeed suicide attempts, many are not. The challenge lies in identifying which acts indicate suicidal intent versus those that serve other purposes like emotional regulation, self-punishment, or seeking relief from emotional pain. This distinction is vital because recognizing genuine suicide risk could save lives, while misinterpreting non-suicidal self-harm can lead to inappropriate interventions. Determining suicidal intent is difficult even for experienced clinicians, requiring careful assessment of multiple factors, including method, lethality, planning, and circumstances. Traditional risk assessment tools that use checklists of factors have proven surprisingly inaccurate for predicting future behavior. While the suicide rate among people seen at hospitals after self-harm is approximately 50 times higher than in the general population, this still means most people who self-harm don't die by suicide. This statistical reality makes identification of those at highest risk extremely difficult, particularly in the weeks and months following an episode of self-harm. People often give vague or mixed responses about their intentions, sometimes saying they just wanted out or to switch off from problems. Some describe feeling both suicidal and non-suicidal impulses simultaneously, while others report their intentions changed during the act itself. Research shows that asking someone about suicidal thoughts doesn't increase suicide risk. In fact, not asking may send the dangerous message that certain topics are off limits. Open, direct conversations about suicide can provide relief and create opportunities for intervention. Paradoxically, self-harm can sometimes function as protection against suicide, serving as a coping mechanism that helps people survive intense emotional pain. For many, it serves as a middle ground between suicidal thoughts and actually ending one's life, a way to put a full stop to overwhelming thoughts without complete self-destruction. Some describe it as a way to feel something when emotionally numb or to express pain they can't verbalize. However, this isn't universally true. For some individuals, self-harm can be practice for suicide or can escalate over time into more lethal behavior. The relationship between self-harm and suicide often shifts over time, making ongoing assessment crucial. Professional help is important, as friends and family shouldn't bear the burden of assessing suicide risk. Mental health professionals are trained to conduct thorough risk assessments and can provide appropriate interventions, whether that's crisis planning, therapy, medication, or hospitalization when necessary. They can also help distinguish between different types of self-harm and tailor treatment accordingly, while supporting both the individual and their support network through the recovery process. When someone self-harms, they're clearly troubled, regardless of dismissive comments suggesting they're just seeking attention or making excuses. Even if such observations contain some truth, we must ask how distressed someone must be to harm themselves for attention or to avoid difficulties. Self-harm isn't merely a sign of distress, it's also the person's way of dealing with that distress. Physical activities like exercise can improve our mental state by affecting our emotions. Similarly, self-harm functions as emotional regulation through several mechanisms. Some people experience relief through expectation, believing self-harm will help makes it actually help. Many overdose with painkillers or sedatives, seeking calm and escape from emotional turmoil. For others, physical pain from self-injury provides a counterbalance to emotional pain, making it more manageable. Self-harm can also address depersonalization, that disturbing feeling of unreality or disconnection from oneself that some experience. The physical sensation can bring them back to life. However, the main problem with using self-harm for emotional control is that relief is temporary and negative feelings eventually return, now compounded by thoughts about the self-harm itself. Many who self-harm do so as a form of self-punishment, often because they blame themselves for their troubles. This may stem from having internalized blame from abusers or from a tendency to assume responsibility for negative events in their lives. Self-harm becomes a way of proving their worthlessness or seeking forgiveness. Some describe the physical act, particularly bleeding, as washing away the badness from inside them. Distress involves not just emotions, but intrusive negative thoughts and memories. Self-harm, being such an intense, present experience, can temporarily block these mental intrusions. The physical pain diverts attention, and even the aftermath, cleaning up, bandaging, provides distraction from painful thoughts. While self-harm always begins as a response to distress, over time it can evolve to serve additional purposes for those who repeat the behavior. Like any habitual behavior, people continue self-harm because they get something from it. Otherwise, they would stop. The language of addiction often appears in discussions about self-harm, with people describing struggles to stay clean or avoid returning to the habit. This doesn't mean people self-harm for kicks or for fun. Such dismissive thinking shows prejudice and lack of understanding. Rather, for those who repeatedly self-harm, it can offer certain positive experiences that make it difficult to stop. Perhaps the most common positive aspect people report about self-harm is that it gives them a sense of control over some part of their lives. This is particularly significant for people who otherwise feel powerless and hopeless about shaping their circumstances. Even when seeking help, many are reluctant to stop self-harming because they perceive it as something that belongs to them, that no one can take away, their own decision and domain of control. Self-harm involves risk and pain that not everyone can endure. For some, this creates a sense of achievement or resilience, not pride or gloating, but recognition of their ability to survive adversity. It can reinforce a belief in their strength and self-sufficiency, especially for those who feel they cannot rely on others for support. Beyond simply removing unpleasant emotions, self-harm can sometimes produce genuinely pleasurable feelings. While extreme forms involving excitement or arousal from planning and executing self-harm are uncommon, many experience pleasant physical or emotional sensations afterward, a warm, calm feeling of relaxation. Self-harm can help establish a sense of identity for those struggling to know who they are. This isn't about forgetting basic facts like one's name, but about deeper aspects of identity. Having a meaningful existence to others, fitting in rather than feeling like a misfit, being able to communicate emotionally, and having ownership of one's body, especially difficult for those who've experienced abuse. For those struggling with self-harm, there are practical steps toward feeling better. Not all suggestions will work for everyone, so it's helpful to view attempts as experiments rather than measures of personal worth. If self-help proves insufficient, seeking outside help is essential. While basic lifestyle changes might seem trivial compared to self-harm's complexity, they serve two purposes: improving mood and signaling to yourself that you're worth the effort. Small changes challenge the black-and-white thinking that dismisses partial progress as worthless. Food affects mood, and eating a balanced diet with regular meals can help you feel better. The focus isn't just what you eat, but how, sitting at a table rather than snacking in the kitchen or before the TV. Research shows giving up alcohol significantly reduces self-harm rates. Nearly half of people treated after self-harm had been drinking or using cannabis beforehand. Alcohol and drugs alter mood and contribute to sudden emotional dips, making it advisable to stop or reduce use, especially when alone and feeling low. Exercise helps lift mood and interrupts negative thought patterns. Start with small changes, getting off the bus a stop early, taking stairs instead of elevators, and gradually build in scheduled activities like classes or weekly jogs. Even brief walks during inactive, unenjoyable periods can make a difference. Music powerfully affects mood, sometimes calming, but sometimes deepening misery. Learn which music lifts your spirits and which makes you feel sad or lonely. Then avoid the latter when alone or already feeling low. Small personal treats, a favorite place, film, food, or drink, aren't trivial, but affirm your self-worth. When facing a crisis, having a pre-prepared plan is essential. Try to slow down the action by stopping to think before acting impulsively. Identify exactly what the problem is, write it down from your perspective, consider how it compares to past problems, and try seeing it from different angles. Next, brainstorm possible solutions and carefully select one to try first. When someone you care about reveals they're self-harming, your role isn't to be their therapist, but to provide support while they get formal help if needed. It's natural to feel shocked, hurt, angry, or guilty when learning someone you care about is self-harming. While honesty about your feelings is important, expressing them too forcefully can shut down communication. Speak calmly, say a little at a time, pause to let the other person respond, and try to remain supportive even while processing your own emotions. Try to understand how the person feels about their self-harm, what they've done, and what they want now. Ask gentle questions without interrogating them. When discussing suicide, acknowledge that many distressed people have such thoughts. Explore whether these are passing thoughts or concrete plans, what might stop them from acting, and discuss what you both can do to ensure safety during crises. Ask why they've chosen to confide in you specifically and what help they're seeking. Be realistic about what support you can offer. A shared plan based on mutual understanding is more sustainable than one-sided expectations. Don't feel guilty about acknowledging your own limitations. Respect confidentiality. Adults, and even younger people, have the right to decide who knows about their health issues. Avoid telling others just because you're worried, as this may break trust. The exception is when you genuinely believe someone is at immediate risk of suicide, especially if their judgment seems impaired by mental health issues. Be ready for frustration, anger, or upset if your efforts don't lead to obvious change or seem unwanted. You might wonder if you're doing something wrong or if the self-harm is directed at you. These feelings are natural, but what's important is not rejecting the person who self-harms. Supporting them requires patience and acceptance, even when understanding is difficult. As Jane, mother of a daughter who's been self-harming for 8 years, says, "I don't love her for what she does. I love her for who she is. I just have to be there." Ensure you have your own emotional support system, too. Healthcare experiences for those who self-harm vary dramatically. While some receive excellent care, others encounter dismissive or even hostile responses. To make the most of a typical 8 to 10 minute GP appointment, prepare carefully. Consider bringing someone supportive who can provide emotional backup and help remember details. Decide what you want to say and write it down to avoid forgetting key points. Your plan should include what you want to tell the doctor, what questions you want to ask, and what help you're hoping to receive. GPs often don't refer self-harm patients to mental health specialists due to underfunding, long waiting times, and service restrictions. Many mental health services only see people with diagnosed mental illness, and some won't treat anyone with suicide risk. Your GP may need to manage your care themselves or refer you to local voluntary organizations. Don't automatically reject referral to mental health services out of fear. They're not just about medication, and you might find therapy helpful. You might visit an emergency department, A&E, for physical treatment after self-harm, such as for overdoses requiring antidotes or cuts needing stitches. However, A&E isn't ideal for urgent mental health care. It's busy with high patient turnover and limited time for thorough psychological evaluation. When arriving at A&E, you'll first provide personal information to reception staff during booking in. A triage nurse will then quickly assess how urgently you need medical attention, prioritizing life-threatening conditions. This means you may wait hours during busy periods, not because staff are punishing you, but because they must make difficult workload decisions. According to NICE guidelines, comprehensive assessment should lead to developing a collaborative risk management plan to keep you safe, discussing potential benefits of psychological interventions for self-harm, and creating a support plan during any transition to other services. The assessment aims to start a discussion about what's best for you after leaving the department. NICE emphasizes that all assessments and plans should be made with you, not just about you. Self-harm is stigmatized for multiple reasons. It's self-inflicted and thus seen as undeserving of sympathy. Its underlying causes are dismissed. It's associated with women in a gender-biased society. It's attributed to personality abnormalities. And it's viewed as untreatable and a waste of professionals' time. This stigmatization manifests in dehumanizing labels like cutter or self-harmer that reduce people to their behavior, and dismissive characterizations of self-harm as merely attention-seeking or manipulative. Even when self-harm is intended to elicit care from others, this reflects desperation rather than manipulation. Recognizing that self-harm often responds to stressful circumstances rather than just individual psychological problems raises the possibility of environmental and societal interventions to reduce rates. Since self-harm becomes common around secondary school age and nearly all children attend school, school-based prevention programs are logical. these increasingly popular programs aim to teach children alternative ways of managing stress and emotional symptoms, as self-harm may seem like the default response when alternatives aren't suggested. Alcohol and drug use are strongly associated with self-harm, and policies making these substances more available could increase risk for vulnerable people. While debates about minimum alcohol pricing and drug decriminalization are complex, any policy changes should consider potential impacts on those most likely to self-harm. Social media's relationship with self-harm is complex. Research shows troubled young people tend to spend more time online, while excessive online time can reinforce isolation. When examining social media posts about self-harm, researchers found most content wasn't actively encouraging harm, but exploring broader themes like body image, gender identity, belonging, and relationships. The evidence suggests most social media use by those who self-harm is about expressing emotions safely rather than encouraging harmful behavior, though limiting excessive screen time remains beneficial for physical and social health. The journey to understanding and responding to self-harm isn't straightforward, but it begins with compassion, both for ourselves and others. By moving beyond stereotypes and stigma, we can create spaces where healing becomes possible and where those who self-harm can find pathways to expressing their pain in less destructive ways.